We are going to continue the Write the Right talks with a keynote by Ruth Okediji from Harvard Law School. She is a professor of law at Harvard Law School and the co-director of Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Her research and scholarship examine issues of innovation policy, economic development, human rights, and global knowledge governance. Please, Professor Okediji.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be at this conference. And I had made mention during the workshop that if I ever decide I want to be a singer, that someone should kindly take me to the side and tell me that I have no real future in that. But I am really delighted to be around so many artists and to be in a forum where we can really focus on what I think has historically been the forgotten focus of copyright law, and that is the creative community. A central and persistent question in copyright law today has to do increasingly not with its design or with its doctrinal efficacy, although there is certainly much to say about that, and copyright scholars have been thinking in their own way about reimagining copyright since copyright itself began. But rather, the question that has persisted has to do with the moral intuitions of copyright, this question of whether copyright maintains a fidelity to her objectives. Put differently, copyright law has been, in my words, ensnared in a deepening moral crisis. We all recognize throughout legal regimes that law informs power, and that the legitimacy of law is inextricably bound to its purposes. So when law is perceived to be unfettered, misaligned with a just purpose, society often questions its moral status or describes that law as unfair. This, I think, is the story of much of copyright law today. As copyright law's stated purpose to improve human welfare seems less and less related to the fundamental assumptions that inform the law, a fundamental assumption that we need copyright to present us with incentives to create, that assumption has led to increasing questions about what copyright law is for. Because clearly, artists and creatives are doing a lot of their creativity sustaining their creativity and enduring the creative environment, often at the risk of violating copyright law, but rarely at the possibility of benefiting from it. So the question then is, why copyright? Why copyright law? Why not other legal regimes, including ones that might be entirely made up, entirely new ones? The intellectual property narrative that has dominated this discourse about creativity has not produced a compelling or morally satisfying account of reward for human creativity. While it has enabled the commodification, and many would argue the global distribution of creative goods, intellectual property, and specifically copyright law, has for many, many artists mediated what I call a culture of impoverishment. Indeed, I think some would argue that copyright law has mediated an exclusion, in some cases, a downright elimination of certain forms of creativity, particularly those forms of creativity that are unbending to its conforming power. Because, of course, copyright law, indeed, is embedded within powerful institutions itself, has become a powerful institution dispensing power, regulating power, and in many ways denying power. And of course, music is one of these commodities and one of these copyrightable subject matters that has particularly been vulnerable to the non-conforming interests that underlie copyright law when first imagined. When you look at music from indigenous communities or music from the global south, or even music from disenfranchised communities in the global north, It is clear that copyright is not an equal playing field. The persistent doctrines of copyright law demand a particular expression of creativity. Copyright law produces particular institutions that necessarily compromise, weaken the individual liberty and autonomy that once informed the fabric around which much of global copyright law once emerged. And nowhere is this more evident, in my view, than in the regulation of song and music. Music has been central to the making of culture. It is a vital part of the cultural DNA of societies around the world. We sing anthems, we sing folk songs, spiritual songs, fight songs. These are things that we pass on from generation to generation. We pass our values, we pass our principles, we pass our stories through the medium of song. In fact, so powerful is music and song that in many of the key social struggles of our time, be it the civil rights movement in the United States, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, to many of the great political and social struggles of society, the power of music has been a vital sustaining force. It has been a vital force reinforcing the ideological and the moral values that have been foundational to the demand for legal change in virtually every aspect of society. Entire genres of music, for example, rap music, found their legitimacy and found their inspiration in the need to demand legal and cultural change. And so music has both been a trigger of power and a reflection of power. And because of its centrality to what I call culture making, and its centrality to culture expression, and its centrality to cultural preservation, the legal framework that governs music speaks to an essential part of both political and market power. In both of these arenas, political power and market power, as the previous panel noted, music and other forms of copyrighted works have fared very badly. As one scholar notes, music as a form of intentional sound-related action includes a spectrum of things. It includes listening, it includes making in all of its productive forms, improvising, composing, arranging, conducting, and then record producing. All of these integrations of music with dance and music and worship are all part of what we refer to as music, and it is the ecosystem of music copyright. But perhaps more than any other copyrighted work, music copyright in particular has found itself in a deeply antagonistic posture with copyright law. Music copyright, I think more than any other area of copyright law, reveals contradictions both in our theory and in our practice. So first of all, copyright law, as I said, is deeply antagonistic to music creatives. The idealized view of law as a mechanism to spur creativity and to protect artists stands in very sharp contrast with the practice of copyright law as a tool of disempowerment. And I want to argue that in material respects, copyright law has written creatives out of its justification for existing. So it's no surprise, I think, that current generations of creatives are deeply skeptical while remaining largely ignorant of the role of copyright law in shaping the scope and the span of their respective careers. So while we have widespread skepticism, there also tends to be widespread acquiescence to the existing framework that exists. As currently structured, a large number of players in the particular context of music, we think of record labels, we think of publishers, we think of distributors, platforms today, streaming companies, all benefit, it appears, far more than creators. Scholars argue that it's because incentives are misaligned, because we've directed incentives at distributors. Others argue that it's a matter of remuneration and the incapacity, the lack of ease of facilitating direct remuneration to artists. But ultimately, the question is the copyright law as a system that rewards artists is a fallacy. And it's a fallacy that has several breaking points, but perhaps it breaks down entirely when it comes to music, because in addition to inadequately rewarding artists, in addition to writing artists many times out of the copyright story, music copyright also perpetuates complex and historical models of inequality. So let's step back a little bit in history. The earliest copyright statutes in both Europe and the United States were originally designed to protect literary works. Music, interestingly enough, pushed its way into this regime, largely because various laws were capacious enough. The word writing could be stretched to encompass music, and certainly printed music. And because creators fundamentally had no alternative, there were no other legal regimes to capture the spectrum of what we have defined as the musical enterprise or the music enterprise. But of course, we know in this room and elsewhere that musical works are quite different from literary works, both in their form and in their function. For example, musical works are often more performative, and they are much more relational in nature than literary works. Now, the patronage arrangements and public performances in Europe made music composers, and certainly in the United Kingdom, very cautious about copyright. They were, in fact, initially uninterested in copyright protection and fought against it, as did the music publishers of that time. So it was ironic, actually, that it was internal fighting between composers and music publishers that led to a series of cases in equity, cases in which there was no clear statute that was applied, but general rules of equity, of fairness, of what was reasonable, that ultimately led to a decision that, in fact, music falls within the copyright arena. And so the doctrines and the normative values of fairness and of equity that governed the budding music industry fell away as music became firmly entrenched in the Statute of Anne. In other words, copyright protection for music came about as a means of insulating creatives from other, often more powerful actors emerging in the industry. That's where it started. The error, of course, was the idea that just because copyright law could protect printed music, it didn't mean that this protection was sufficient for all of music as a whole. Having come out of a tradition of protection based on written works, copyright law today maintains this bias toward visual and text. This visual textual bias favors written aspects of a musical work over the oral components of that work. It also maintains a bias against the psychological and relational components of the creative's enterprise. Now, this visual textual bias may work well for books and for literature, but it does not apply and does not work as well to the sound recording and to the oral performances and to the creative, the collaborative creative process that so dominates the music economy. Similarly, we see this visual textual bias present throughout the US and Western legal systems. And in fact, as Professor Fumi Ariwa has noted, legal practitioners are trained to accept written evidence as dispositive. So in music infringement cases, in music copyright cases, in cases of misappropriation, often the emphasis is on the written evidence as dispositive, not the oral and not the oral evidence. Those are relegated to secondary roles and typically used in contexts where ambiguities exist, as a result of which we find that what is used to determine what serves as the legal relationship between the creative and her work is based on literary text. What tends to happen then is that that textual bias reduces a non-legal and a non-commodifiable aspect of the creative enterprise into something that is commodified, and to a significant extent, it takes the non-visual object, music, which you cannot see, and limits it to its written representation. In part, what this means is that quintessentially, what is original in the copyright sense, what is original to creatives is both underrepresented or misrepresented. In some cases, it is not represented at all in the copyright space. So what is my first claim? My first claim is that copyright is fundamentally mismatched with many aspects of the creative function that we seek attention for in today's copyright economy. The absence of the creative spirit that is reflected in the full complement of musical expression is in fact limited by the literary nature of this legal frame. We transpose it onto this legal regime of property, which confers excludability both in what counts as music and in how you might enforce your musical ownership. In sum, copyright law takes the authority over what is music and what rights a musical creative is entitled to away from the creative community and puts it into the hands of other actors. Copyright law, in its effort to protect the incentives to create, in fact, disenfranchises creators. Second, when we focus protection on the written composition of music rather than the performative elements, rather than the relational elements between the creator and her work, it has had a profound structural and doctrinal consequence on copyright law. Indeed, first of all, we see that this literary bias has systematically underserved the great majority of cultures whose artistic form is oral and performative. This includes indigenous groups around the world, many cultures in the global south. Moreover, the literary bias has meant that those who are minority groups, even within literary cultures, this includes artists, of course, but who have a lower literacy rate, who may not be credentialed, who are not part of institutionalized educational settings, have been subject systematically to appropriation and to the reconstruction of their cultures. In Australia, for example, the appropriation of Aboriginal music has been subject to westernization, the idea of taking Aboriginal music and making it sound like something that the Western cultural air might better appreciate, is long been chronicled in Australian history. Now, that appropriation today might be called remixing, except, of course, it has been stripped of the integrity of the Aboriginal creative spirit. Within music and in the industrial scaffolding around music, this literary bias has produced what I call a hierarchy within music creatives itself. It has been meant to say that access to mainstream culture, certainly in the US, is the predominant pathway to exercise your creative spirit in broader national or global markets. Indigenous cultures, minority cultures, have to fight their way through that. And so copyright law's grip on this textual and visual components of music, and relatedly the bias impact on communities with low literacy, underserves those vulnerable cultures. And those global zones have been traditionally marginalized in the commodification of a global market for music. The questions of who owns music, who's entitled to copyright protection, now becomes less about the actual creative work, but instead about who has the capital to utilize the biases inherent in the copyright system in their favor. So let me turn now to what has always been, I think, the definitive statement to justify copyright law. Every copyright textbook and most copyright statutes around the world, including trade agreements that codify copyright law, always point to the public interest as the rationale for copyright. The public interest, of course, justifies the commodification of creative work because it is necessary to get cultural goods into the hands of the consuming public. And so from authorship to the public, the creator becomes the intermediated. When the first US copyright statute was enacted in 1790, it actually did not have music. And while it was stretched to accommodate music, it wasn't really until 1831 that it explicitly protected music. But then as 19th century technologies enabled written compositions of musical works and the capacity to distribute to large audiences, copyright law responded. And it responded not by saying to the author, you have the right to control and to develop new ways of distribution. It responded by relating legal doctrine to the technologies of distribution in the interest of the public. In other words, the first and greatest responsibility in this frame of copyright law is not the nurturing of creative artistic expression, but the commodification and distribution of copyrighted works to the public. It should then not be surprising that what we see today in copyright law is the, as I said earlier, sometimes downright elimination of the creative from our narrative. This link to the advent of new technologies and the revision of copyright law to accommodate its point, to accommodate it, points really to the crucial role of business and commercial capital in distorting the copyright frame. The need to reimagine copyright is not because of an absence of creativity, but of the very presence of commodification as its central unifying force. The evolution of music copyright has always involved this contestation between political power and market power and creative power. And that contestation has not gone away. And so the challenge of protecting music through copyright is that while literary works primarily manifest as people reading individually, typically engaging in the text themselves, in fact, music often operates as a collective cultural mechanism, bringing people together, identifying particular cultures, and expressing itself in the collaborative process that produces music. And so what happens then is that copyright law, because it alienates the collaborative, because copyright law often eliminates the non-literary, and because it doesn't recognize the non-visual elements of the creative process, alienates, of course, the artist from her work entirely. When work and music in particular is alienated from the artist, it's broken up, as you see in copyright infringement cases, into these discrete components that never existed until the question of infringement arose. Copyright works in music are broken up into their lyrics and into the written composition, into the intricacies of its sound recording and the uniqueness of its performative manifestation. And all of this distorts the creative enterprise because, of course, music, much like its other, or unlike its other copyrighted peers, is not produced in pieces. The paradigm of copyright for words and for the collection of words, or the copyright for the composition, seems ill-equipped to address this existential nature of music. And the separation between the artist and her work is pretty endemic in copyright law. We see this in the work for hire agreements that are signed by artists, who often stepping into a relationship with employers are signing away the power to create and own what they create. Now, some of these elements have been addressed by termination rights in the United States, and most recently in the European Union, the Digital Single Market Directive on revocation. But of course, what we have seen in these legal regimes is a transformation of property interests to contractual private interests. We've moved from the focus on property to a focus on the private instruments, the use of private instruments of power in the creative market. The artist, whether it's property or contract, is still subject to the vulnerable disembodiment of his or her work. But of course, creatives have not been silent. In the United States, we are beginning to see new forms of musical shows and rewards for artists from leading artists in the field. All of this fueled by a skepticism of the private contract, which is replacing, of course, the default rules of copyright law. The move away from recording contracts and other kinds of contracts with labels points repeatedly to this uneasy tension that has existed in copyright law. And the trend has been particularly virulent when looking at African-American communities and at indigenous communities and at the history of underground communities in the global north. Many, many artists aren't able to get into the mainstream, not because the works aren't creative or subject to copyright, but because structural barriers make entry difficult. And so for that reason, I have been arguing in our workshop the last 2 days, but also in some of my work, about reinstituting or reconceiving of a right to be heard. A fundamental obligation on platforms and traditional intermediaries to accommodate the voices of diversity, to accommodate low-income artists, to accommodate a variety of creative expression, and to preclude the possibility of instantaneous consolidation in the marketplace. And so that suggests to me that our focus in reimagining copyright can't just be on the outcome of what copyright law does, but on the very structure of the markets that facilitate that. And what is it that creates the systemic undervaluing and elimination of the artistic voice and the artist himself or herself in copyright's framework? Well, it is the very thing that copyright law created as a construct to empower artists, and that is this distinction between authors and owners. The historical distinction between authorship and ownership, the alienability of an author's rights, was constructed, we are told, as a means to empower authors in the negotiating process, to transpose political power, which many authors did not have, into economic power so that they could assign their rights, so that they could exercise their rights in private markets. But while copyright vests in the person that fixes the work in a tangible medium of expression, for many, many creatives, that authorship right that becomes the ownership right is very quickly dissolved. Ownership, for most creatives, is the first thing that is divested as the commodification effect takes in. In fact, some authors would say that ownership never vests at all. The mismatch between what copyright law purports to do in spurring creativity and what it actually does in rewarding artists is quite disturbing. It points to an imbalance not just of doctrine, but an imbalance of structures and an imbalance within institutions. It points to this construct of power relations that exist within, you know, in the music industry, but frankly, in other industries as well. And it is copyright law that fundamentally reinforces these structural imbalances. It is important, I think, for us to note that copyright law influences the realities of who curates culture, because it creates the conditions for more widespread access to the particular products of culture that have conformed to these structural limitations. The production of a common culture is harder and harder today because publishers, record labels, performing rights organizations, broadcasters, you name them, are justified in their efforts to release commodities to the public. And so despite the historic underpinnings of copyright law that is tied to authorship, we find that artists neither control nor derive the most benefit from their work. Now, some people might be fine with that outcome. But I think, again, to go back to my earlier comments, that to the extent that the law is going to be viewed as legitimate, there must be some connection between what the law facilitates and the purposes of that law and the persons to whom those purposes are directed. The way that we have accounted and conceived of copyright law as a property right, this intangible medium, means that the exclusive ability to control their works is also divested from the author. We see this in the Berne Convention. And so, of course, as Professor Jane Ginsburg has noted, it is no accident that copyright law and other common law countries in particular see alienability as a reflection of autonomy. But that autonomy, of course, is only illusory. That autonomy, which is supposed to empower artists in the marketplace, is the very thing that disenfranchises them in that marketplace. And so the consequences of this distinction between ownership and authorship becomes not only procedural, who gets to exercise the right,
but it also becomes substantive, who controls the revenue. The distinction doesn't just lead to financial inequity in terms of remuneration, but it also embeds loss of control as a fundamental part of the architecture of copyright law. And so when we think about reimagining copyright, a number of propositions, I think, are critical. There must be, in my view, a dissolution, a dissembling of this author-owner distinction. We must begin to think, in my view, of a certain core minimum of inalienable rights that belong to artists. When we note that disempowerment is particularly not only a reflection of what the market returns to artists, but it also translates into cultural power, the capacity of artists to represent themselves before politicians, before policymakers, is greatly diminished because intermediaries ranging from platforms to performing rights organizations to collecting societies all stand in the place of the artist, not supplementing the artist's efforts, but replacing it almost altogether. When famous artist Jay-Z was interviewed about his decision to transition from being an author to being an owner, he had this to say: "I work for my company to use my music so that I can get that music to the markets that want to hear me." He said, as I quote, "Owning your own master recordings means that you get to decide what to do with your music and not someone else. You get to negotiate, you get to define the parameters of that music, and you get more say in the percentages of remuneration that come back to you." Beethoven actually had this insight years ago, when he said the musician has to also be a business person. Ultimately, the question of eliminating the distinction between ownership and authorship has practical implications for copyright doctrine. The first, of course, is the possibility of what the EU now refers to as revocation, but what in the US is often termed termination. Not every artist can create their own company, and not every artist ought have to do so. The challenge is how we create an ecosystem around artists that consists not only of property rights, but of contractual rights. Contractual rights that, if in my view of reimagining copyright, consists of inalienable rights, are irrevocable. And so the termination right, the mechanism that allows you to pull back from a contract that is no longer equitable, is an important area of reform in copyright law. In sum, if we reform copyright to address the imbalances in power that exist not only institutionally but structurally and even in copyright doctrine, we must also reinvest in the institutions that will make it possible for artists to begin to exercise greater control not only over the content of their work but the commodification of their work. In the United States, we often quote that the primary objective of copyright law is not to reward the labor of authors. And I want to say, as I mentioned earlier, that this antagonism to the labor of authors in many ways explains the limits of copyright law for the kind of cultural production that we need. The transformation of copyright law, moving ownership and authorship into one category, creating a minimum core of inalienable rights, preserving market power by granting rights of revocation or termination, work best within a reframing of copyright law, not as a law intended to benefit a public for whom the artist is not a part of, but as a law that recognized the labor of artists as something that is part of the ecosystem of copyright. A crucial part of the history of copyright's disenfranchisement of the artist means that copyright law requires these inalienable rights, whether there are rights to be heard, whether there are rights to a minimum remuneration, whether there are rights to revoke contracts with intermediaries, and I would suggest a restructuring of the nature of the legal obligation between intermediaries and artists from one that is just contract to one that is fiduciary. Professor Cohen and I and several other scholars have made this point, that the relationship between intermediaries and artists that is structured now as merely a contract between two equal persons, when we know that this is not the case, ought to be stylized into more of a fiduciary relationship that captures both the economic and the non-economic value of music production. For indigenous and traditional communities, the options, of course, remain fairly open. There's an emerging problem concerning the governance of culture and who gets to define access to that culture. We must create a copyright law, as I conclude, that prioritizes rights that are designed to accomplish the human welfare goals of creators rather than the production of commodifiable subject matter. We must work to enact laws that benefit the integrity of the musical enterprise and its production, and not just the distribution of creative output that is measured by sales. If the legal structures that we create overvalue commodification, then it cannot be a surprise that it also undervalues creators. The current structure of our markets creates barriers for distribution. Copyright law gives us more rights to produce more works, but little rights to actually have artists enjoy the fruits of their labor. Could we envision a system in which production and distribution companies are, as I said, not only fiduciaries, but they're also guardians rather than investors? As Professor Cohen, Julie Cohen, argues, a reformed copyright law, a reimagined copyright law, must provide a framework within which authors and intermediaries can come together to negotiate the terms of the production of culture. In essence, they must be stewards together, if at all, of the public interest. If we believe fundamentally in the role of culture in producing creatives, if we believe in rewarding the creative enterprise, if we believe in the importance of nourishing democratic ideals and in the necessity of disciplining markets, then reimagining copyright is not just a cry for the reform of copyright law. It is an imperative of transforming the institutions that surround copyright and of reframing the discourse, not as one of property or contract, but one of responsibility and accountability and transparency in the protocols of both the political and the music markets. Thank you very much.
I have a couple of questions, actually. First, when you were talking about what is copyright for, who is it for, and who profits the most, I wanted to get your opinion on the new copyright directive and, of course, on the 17th or the 13th article in terms of the effect it already had on the streaming platforms. That we saw that Spotify canceled the beta program, and in my opinion, that kind of hinders creativity, since only licensed distributors and publishers can now upload content on the platform. So I would love to hear your opinion on that article.
Do you want me to do one by one, or you want to take a couple of questions? And how much time do we have? So maybe we should take a couple so that we can.
Mine is a slightly more philosophical question, but I think it was an important one asked just now. So you rightly stress, that music is performative and therefore relational, and but still your solutions really start with kind of individual rights. So if meaning is generated essentially in a process and by the user, can the solution be a rights-based approach?
Do
Thank you. It's actually quite direct to what you said and to the ending of your speech, and I was just unfortunately missing the beginning. Just and maybe it's only a remark, but it's because it's quite, to me, a quite new thought. No, not so new. When you think of law, I think of it's basically a lot of text, especially also in Germany, where we right now are. And so I come very quickly to the interpretation of texts, which uses to be in, which, when it is, when I'm talking about an artistic text or literature, and then this is to publicity. So very quick.
So let me just start with Spotify and DSM, and I won't speak directly to Spotify, but I think your question is more structural. You know, we have these reforms that purport to you know, support or enable or somehow enhance the interests of creatives, but they end up in many instances perhaps harming them, because platforms in particular today react in ways that may damage the opportunities, especially for individual and smaller performers and artists. I think this is a important issue. One of the reasons I'm not a fan of property or contracts as the ultimate solution is precisely because I think the laws are never going to be neutral enough to facilitate outcomes that work well, particularly for those who lack capital. We have created a culture, a creative culture that is capital intensive, and that's a challenge. But if so, let me give you two possibilities. If we are going to not reimagine copyright, and we're going to keep with a copyright system that is capital intensive, then there must be more demand on the institution and the apparatus of the state to become involved in the funding of cultural works. Otherwise, you will always have the structural imbalance between those who have access to capital and those who don't. And if access to capital is a necessary prerequisite, you're going to find that platforms will negotiate in ways to provide you with access, but that will limit or define the terms and conditions on what you on which you engage them. And this is exactly what's happening with Spotify. So one is to say that in the decision to cancel this beta service, artists are going to have to either maintain some leverage in the contracts that they sign with the licensed distributors, et cetera, or they're going to have to create alternatives to that. Now, there's a session on platforms tomorrow, but I think this goes to the regulation, frankly, of platforms and to the contractual basis on which they operate. Because if we conceived of platforms as fiduciaries or as stewards, that's not a decision that would have gone unexamined. That's not a decision that would have been unaccounted for. As it is, because we view intermediaries as legitimate claimants of the current copyright system, there's a level of deference to these platforms that, in my view, is not fully merited. If they were fiduciaries of the creative musicians, then the impact of that decision on a spectrum of musicians would have been weighed vis-a-vis the business interest that may have been articulated. And I think this is the kind of balancing technique that is going to be necessary as the implementation of the directive goes forth. I think we have to start with a reframing or reimagining of the current framework, because intermediaries at the moment stand on an equal, if not greater, footing than artists themselves. And if that's the case, those decisions become insulated from the kind of critique that is necessary to undo them. So I find that problematic. And I think, as the person here in front has already said, you know, laws are going to be interpreted.
They'll be interpreted by the platforms, they'll be interpreted by artists. And the platforms who control the resources, that interpretation is going to stand, and artists will either, or creators will have to either fall in line, or they will have to challenge those within, hopefully, a newly constructed framework. The only legal regime, in my view, that offers that possibility is some form of competition or antitrust law, as we call it in the United States. It's not a fiduciary or stewardship relationship, but it at least provides an opportunity to examine the basis for the decision that the platforms are making. There has got to be discipline in the markets. I do not think we can reimagine copyright without also providing tools to discipline markets, and I think that's essential. And to the question about individual rights, I think the real question is not whether we have individual rights, but whether everyone has the same kinds of rights, and whether everyone is similarly in a position to exercise those rights. So it's not so much individuality as me versus them, but the capacity to join my rights with yours so that as a collective we can engage in the process of defining what counts as ownership, what counts as fair remuneration, and what counts for purposes of constraining the work of third actors. I think the collaborative nature of music has presented really difficult problems for copyright law. And copyright law has never been good with anything that is beyond the individual. And this is also a strong tension with music. But you see that some courts in Australia have, in fact, used this notion of a fiduciary relationship between the co-producers. In the United States, we do more havoc, I think, under our laws because co-owners in the copyright sphere can act as independents and are not forced to act as collectives. But we need much more nuanced but simple mechanisms to allow the collectives to operate either as a network or as sets of interests that are being leveraged internally for the benefit of the collective. That's going to be at odds with our individualist tendencies in copyright law. And again, it made sense for books. Most books are consumed individually. And so that is a structure that made sense. Music is consumed individually, but the greatest musical expressions are in groups and in communities. And that fundamental difference, I think, compels us to reimagine something different for music.
So when you spoke about the appropriation of music for indigenous authors or just indigenous communities, do you think this is in some way or another connected to the absence of moral rights in the common law systems?
Yeah. I think it's connected to the loss of power and the absence of moral rights. So it's the appropriation of something that is legally defined as free isn't even appropriation. And so as I pointed out in the early part of my talk, one of the clear consequences of copyright is how it has structurally discriminated against particular kinds of music and particular kinds of people. And you see that if you see a chart of music revenue, you will see the disproportionate flows. That's not because music isn't created, but because how you get access to that remuneration requires you to give up certain rights. And for indigenous communities where music is not fixed, the protection of musical forms in those communities is virtually non-existent. And it's for that reason that that's not just a function of the visual and literary bias of copyright, it's also the lack of legal place that indigenous communities have. And I think there's a parallel happening with creatives even in the global north. The collaborative nature, but also the independent nature of music production, and the distinctiveness of musical sound is such that copyright law doesn't often recognize that. And so that belongs, we say, to the public domain. But it's a structural imbalance that means that certain forms of music are always going to be undervalued. Again, I think it's artificial intelligence and its capacity to produce music is going to bring all of this to a head. Because if it's not the creator, if it's not the artist that is at the center of our legal institutions, then we have created a regime that makes it easy for algorithms to spit out music and call it music and simply focus on economic return without the right of control. And I think artists need both. I think artists need both the right of control and the right of return. I think if we do not, in any future of copyright law, if we don't accompany doctrinal reform with institutions that empower authors, we're going to find that the existing institutions that are reinforced by political power will simply reframe the reframing and return us to a kind of status quo, even though it may look different. In fact, we may see that the nature of the rights are transformed and the rights discourse looks very different for authors. Every time we have tried to reimagine copyright, we have ended up taking just a little bit more from creators. And any reimagining needs to really stop and think about what institutional buffers you might put in place to ensure that that doesn't happen. Thank you.
And we carry on with the program here in 5 minutes.